Yes, please do have a seat. What we're going to be doing in our Bible teaching for the next four Sundays is we're going to take a journey through the book of Esther and its Old Testament narrative, its story. We want to tell the story, so we're going to read the whole story. There's going to be quite a lot of Bible reading, which is great. If you've got a Bible and you want to be following it, so we're going to do chapters 1 and 2 today, and that's in the church Bibles, is page 501. 501. And when we're ready, it'll come up on the screen. But we'll get to that in a moment. First of all, just think. So you lose your job, you're made redundant, or the doctor gives you the bad news and says, I'm really sorry, but the cancer's returned. Or you fail your exams, or your spouse leaves you for someone else, or your colleague absolutely hates you because you're a Christian and they're telling lies about you and making life miserable at work, and every time you get up to go for work there's this sickness in your stomach because it's just miserable. And someone sends you the pastry verse for the year, someone who loves you and cares for you and is worried about you, and it says, we know that in all things God works for the good of those who love him. And you think, really? Really? All things? Even this thing? God working for my good? I know that's what I'm meant to believe, but I just find it so hard to believe. And many of us have been there. And maybe that's where we are today. Well, the book of Esther is written to people who find Romans 8:28 hard to believe. The book of Esther shows us that Romans 8:28 is absolutely true. The striking thing, you probably know this, about the book of Esther, is that God isn't mentioned. Not even once. Which is quite strange for a book of the Bible. Elsewhere in the Bible, God is so obvious. He's not hidden. He's just so clearly at work, so powerfully at work and in control. So think of the Exodus, the plagues on Egypt, the parting of the Red Sea that God did for his people, the raining down of bread from heaven to sustain them on their way to the promised land, the pillar of cloud that leads them through the wilderness as well. He is just so obviously big and powerful and at work for the good of his people. But in Esther, we've got none of that. No miracles, no demonstration of visible physical power, no words from God, no words to God, no prayer, no mention of him at all. But what the book of Esther does is it gets us to look more carefully to see that though God may seem hidden, he's not hiding. And though he may seem absent, he's very much present. And though he may seem to be inactive, he's very much at work for the good of his people. His name isn't mentioned anywhere, but his fingerprints are everywhere. God has more than one way of working, you know. Strangely, we tend to kind of box him in a bit and think that the mighty God of the universe has only one way of working powerfully in the world. Where he's a bit like that young woman who was preparing a meal in her kitchen, and a friend was there with her having a chat as she prepared the gammon joint, the ham, for cooking. And before she put the ham into the pot to boil, she was boiling this ham, she cut off a third of it, put it to one side, and then put the rest in the pan to boil. And her friend says, well, why did you do that? Why did you cut off that third and then put the rest in the pan to boil? And she said, do you know? I don't know. It was the way I was taught. My mum used to do this. She used to cut off about a third of the ham and set it aside and then cook the rest in the pan. But it got the young woman thinking, she thought, well, next time I see my mum, I'm going to ask her. So she did. She said, mum, you know, why is it when you cook a ham, you always cut off a third and you kind of put it aside and then you put the rest in the pot to boil? And mum said, do you know? I don't know. It's just the way I was taught. Your grandma used to cook the hams that way, and she used to make such lovely hams that I thought, well, I'll just do it the way she does. Never thought of ever doing it any differently. Well, the young woman, she could just couldn't get this out of her brain, and she thought, well, I'm going to ask Grandma. So next time she was round at Grandma, she said, Grandma, why is it that when you cook a ham, you always kind of cut off a third and you lay it aside and you put the rest in the pot to boil? And Grandma's reply was, well, my dear, when your mum was little, we were quite poor, we didn't have much money, and we couldn't afford a pan that was big enough to fit a whole ham in. So what I used to do was cut off about a third and then put the rest in the pan to cook. Just fit in the pan. You see, they got locked in. They got locked into thinking there was only one way of cooking a ham. And sometimes we think of God that way. He's locked in to one way of working with the spectacular signs and miracles and spectacular interventions in our life with lightning and thunder and flashing lights. And if we don't see those things, we conclude that he's not at work, or we conclude that he doesn't care about us. He's not working on behalf of his people. Esther is going to show us that he is. So we're going to read it. Now Simon's going to come up and help me read chapter 1 and a bit of chapter 2. So you might want to follow it on the screens or in the Bibles. So you can use that mic. Esther chapter 1 verse 1. This is what happened during the reign, during the time of Xerxes. The Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces, stretching from India to Kush. At that time, King Xerxes reigned from his royal throne in the citadel of Susa. And in the third year of his reign, he gave a banquet for all his nobles and officials. The military leaders of Persia and Media, the princes and the nobles of the provinces were present. For a full 180 days, he displayed the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and the glory of his majesty. When these days were over, the king gave a banquet lasting 7 days in the enclosed garden of the king's palace for all the people from the least to the greatest who were in the citadel of Susa. The garden had hangings of white and blue linen, fastened with cords of white linen and purple material to silver rings on marble pillars. There were couches of gold and silver on a mosaic pavement of porphyry, marble, mother of pearl, and other costly stones. Wine was served in goblets of gold, each one different from the other. And the royal wine was abundant, in keeping with the king's liberality. By the king's command, each guest was allowed to drink without restriction. For the king instructed all the wine stewards to serve each man with what he wished. Queen Vashti also gave a banquet for the women in the royal palace of King Xerxes. On the seventh day, when King Xerxes was high in spirits from wine, he commanded the seven eunuchs who served him, Mehuman, Biztha, Harbona, Bigtha, Abagtha, Zetha, and Carcass, to bring before him Queen Vashti, wearing her royal crown, in order to display her beauty to the people and nobles, for she was lovely to look at. But when the attendants delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. Since it was customary for the king to consult experts in matters of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times and were closest to the king, Karshina, Shethar, Admatha, Tarshish, Meres, Marcina, and Memucan, the seven nobles of Persia and Media who had special access to the king and were highest in the kingdom. According to law, what must be done to Queen Vashti? He asked. She's not obeyed the command of King Xerxes that the eunuchs have taken to her. Then Memucan replied in the presence of the king and the nobles,
Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against the king, but also against all the nobles and the peoples of all the provinces of King Xerxes. For the queen's conduct will become known to all the women, and so they will despise their husbands and say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, but she would not come. This very day the Persian and Median women and the nobility who have heard about the queen's conduct will respond to all the king's nobles in the same way. There will be no end of disrespect and discord. Therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone else who is better than she. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed throughout all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands, from the least to the greatest.
Well, the king and his nobles were pleased with this advice. So the king did as Memucan proposed. He sent dispatches to all parts of the kingdom, to each province in its own script, and to each people in their own language, proclaiming that every man should be ruler over his own household, using his native tongue. Later, when King Xerxes' fury had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she'd done and what he'd decreed about her. Then the king's personal attendants proposed,
"Let a search be made for beautiful young virgins for the king. Let the king appoint commissioners in every province of his realm to bring all these beautiful young women into the harem at the citadel of Susa. Let them be placed under the care of Hegai, the king's eunuch, who is in charge of the women, and let beauty treatments be given to them. Then let the young woman who pleases the king be queen instead of Vashti."
This advice appealed to the king, and he followed it. To be continued. Thank you, Simon. Okay, so the story of Esther, it happens during the reign of Xerxes, the one who reigned over this vast empire of 127 provinces, from India in the east over to Kush in the west. And Kush is like the northeastern part of Africa, so this empire was huge, covered parts of northeastern Africa, Egypt, Ethiopia, Sudan, northern Sudan, and also parts of Greece as well. It was the biggest empire in the world to that date. And he reigned from 486 BC to 465 BC, so for about 20 years. His name means mighty man, and he was called the King of Kings. The story is set in Susa, that's one of his capitals. More specifically, it's set in the citadel of Susa. Now, the citadel was the center of government, so it's a bit like saying Whitehall in London, or Capitol Hill in Washington, or the Kremlin in Moscow. It's where all the government business took place. And in the third year of his reign, he gives this great banquet for his top brass. The history books tell us that around this time, Xerxes was setting his sights on conquering the whole of Greece, and he's wanting an invasion, so this is probably him entertaining his nobles and his generals to get them on side for this great military enterprise, this war. And so verse 4, for a full 180 days, he displays the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor of his glory and his majesty. "Look at my wealth," he says. "Don't you see what a great and mighty king I am? Join me. Together we can rule the world." In Persian culture, to show someone your power, you showed them your wealth. This was a culture where people were very, very, very impressed by wealth. Have you ever come across a culture like that? We live in one where people are bewitched by wealth, dazzled by it. Well, after the 180 days, he throws this great party in the palace garden for everyone in the citadel, from the least to the greatest. Most of them have probably never been in the palace garden before. Their eyes would have been absolutely popping out of their heads. I mean, mother of pearl patios. I've got this lovely patio. It's made of sandstone, I think. But this is made of mother of pearl. Unbelievable. And the wine came in goblets of gold, and each one unique. And the royal wine was abundant. I mean, you could drink as much as you liked. What a guy Xerxes was. At that time, God's people, the Jews, they were scattered throughout the Persian Empire. And being Jewish meant being different, and you wouldn't get invited to parties like this very often. So you imagine them being there and seeing and experiencing this, the wealth, the food, the wine, the luxury. This is living the dream. This is impressive. And they probably remembered how their grandparents used to talk about the living God and about living for him. And they're thinking, well, where is God? Have you ever seen him throw a party like this? Have you ever seen him displaying his splendor and his glory of his majesty like this? It's impressive. It makes the whole God thing look a bit lame. It makes people who follow God look a bit sad. Just look what they're missing. Forget about God. You're better off siding with Persia. You're better off siding with King Xerxes. Everyone else is. Now, that's the pressure that God's people living in the Persian Empire would have been under. And that's the pressure that God's people can so easily feel today when we're faced with the dazzling wealth and power of the kingdom of the world. But what Esther does is it gets us to look more closely at the culture and ask, you really think that Xerxes is that great? You think his splendor and his majesty is impressive? You're going to give up on God and his kingdom and side with Xerxes and his kingdom? All because you want to go to more parties and you want to mix with the celebrities and the powerful people and the influencers? You want to live the dream? Really? Take a closer look. Verse 10. On day 7 of the banquet, the king is in high spirits from wine. That's a polite way of saying he's drunk. Is that too much? He rules over 127 provinces, but he's ruled by wine. No self-control, so he's not that great. Too much wine has weakened his inhibitions, and we see what he's really like. As he says, I've shown you my wealth, and I've showered you with my wine. Now I'm going to show you my wife. And he orders Queen Vashti to parade before them so that they can admire her. More like ogle her. Persian culture was a culture obsessed with sex. People used each other's bodies to get what they wanted. Men slept with women so they could brag to their mates about their sexual conquests. I don't know if you've ever come across a culture like that. In Persian culture, how you looked was what really mattered. It really counted. Women felt pressured to conform to a particular image of beauty, and if they looked right, they looked good, they were paraded before men at banquets, they were put on the posters in the shopping centres, they were put in magazines and on websites, or they were given the starring roles in films and sometimes might even be given a job. Don't know if you've ever come across a culture like that. And no doubt the men at the banquets are thinking, oh, this is going to be good, it's going to be good, we've seen the wealth, we've tasted the wine, now we're going to see the women. But verse 12, Queen Vashti refused to come. She said no. And it's very awkward. It's very, very embarrassing for the king. And he's absolutely furious. And the narrator is inviting you and me to laugh at him. This mighty king who commands 127 provinces from India to Kush cannot command his wife. He rules over this vast empire, but he doesn't know what to do. And he said, what do I do? Must be a law about this. So he consults his advisors, asks for help. He has no idea on how to conduct his marriage. Not that great. Not that powerful. And Memucan, his advisor, says, this is real. This is serious. This is going to lead to the unraveling of the whole fabric of Persian society. So pass a law that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. That seems a bit of a daft punishment, really. She won't come, so tell her she can't come. Well, she didn't want to come, so you're punishing her by saying she can't come. We're meant to be laughing at these people, these so-called powerful men. And then they say, come on, we'll get all the wives in the empire to respect their husbands. We'll make it illegal not to. We'll pass a law saying that every husband has to be the master of his own household. Now please know that this isn't the Bible's teaching on how men are to conduct their marriage. This is what happens when men think that they are God. And it's ugly. And it's pathetic. And that's Xerxes here. He's a joke. And it gets uglier, doesn't it, as we read on into chapter 2 and this proposed way of finding Vashti's replacement, this empire-wide beauty contest. Most beautiful young virgins from across the empire to be brought to the harem for beauty treatments and for Xerxes to pick the best. And this advice appealed to the king. You bet it appealed to him. And he followed it. Now, let's be clear. This isn't a beauty contest. This is a sex contest. This is sex trafficking. This is Jeffrey Epstein in the 5th century BC. This is women enslaved for sex. You want to be part of this king's kingdom? Really? At first glance, it looks so powerful, it looks so glamorous, it's so impressive, but you take a closer look and it's ugly. The author is exposing Xerxes and worldly power and worldly glamour for what it really is. He wants to break the spell that worldly power and wealth and superficial beauty cast over us. He's saying, do you see how people are abused? Do you really want to be a part of that king's kingdom? You see how small and pathetic this mighty man really is. You see, he's a joke. He's a sick joke. And so we think, yeah, well, actually, yeah, I can see that now. And maybe it's not wise to side with Xerxes and the kingdom of the world, but still doesn't show me where God is in all this. Where is God? It's not as if God's given me any reason to side with him, is there? And that's where the rest of chapter 2 comes in, and the rest of the book. And we're going to pick up where we left off, and we're going to read chapter 2, verse 5 to the end. Lauren's going to come and do that for us. So please do follow it as Lauren reads it to us.
So, continuing from verse 5 to the end of the chapter. Now there was in the citadel of Susa a Jew of the tribe of Benjamin, named Mordecai, son of Jair, the son of Shimei, the son of Kish, who had been carried into exile from Jerusalem by Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, among those taken captive with Jehoiakim, king of Judah. Mordecai had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. When the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many young women were brought to the citadel of Susa and put under the care of Haggai. Esther also was taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Haggai, who was in charge of the harem. She pleased him and won his favour. Immediately he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned her 7 female attendants selected from the king's palace and moved her attendants into the best place in the harem. Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked to and fro near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her. Before a young woman's turn came to go to King Xerxes, she had to complete 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women, 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 with perfumes and cosmetics. And this is how she would go to the king. Anything she wanted was given to her to take with her from the harem to the king's palace. In the evening, she would go there, and in the morning return to another part of the harem to the care of Sheashgaz, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the concubines. She would not return to the king unless he was pleased with her and summoned her by name. When the turn came for Esther, the young woman Mordecai had adopted, the daughter of his uncle Abihail, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favour of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the month of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women, and she won his favour and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head and made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king gave a great banquet, Esther's banquet, for all the nobles and the officials. He proclaimed a holiday throughout the provinces and distributed gifts with royal liberality. When the virgins were assembled a second time, Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate. But Esther kept secret her family background and nationality, just as Mordecai had told her to do so. For she continued to follow Mordecai's instructions as she had done when he was bringing her up. During the time Mordecai was sitting at the king's gate, Bigthana and Teresh, two of the king's officials who guarded the doorway, became angry and conspired to assassinate King Xerxes. But Mordecai found out about the plot and told Queen Esther, who in turn reported it to the king, giving credit to Mordecai. And when the report was investigated and found to be true, the two officials were impaled on poles. All this was recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king.
Great, thanks, Lauren. So we go from foolish kings and powerful people to weak people, ordinary people, God's people, the Jews. We meet Mordecai and Esther. And you see in verse 5, when he gives us Mordecai's heritage, he kind of links, this is the point where he links this story with the bigger story of the Bible, links it to the rest of the Bible. And we're told that Mordecai is of the tribe of Benjamin. So he's one of Abraham's family, one of God's people, the people that God chose to be his vehicle of blessing to the whole world. God's going to mend this broken world, and he's going to use this people, Abraham's family, to do it. And this is the people that he saved out of Egypt and brought into the promised land. And remember, he told them that if they rejected him and if they followed other gods, then he would scatter them and they would go into exile. And that's just what happened. And Mordecai and Esther are a couple of generations on from the exiles who were carried away from Jerusalem to Babylon. And then the Persians conquered the Babylonians, and the Persian king Cyrus said all the Jews could go home to the promised land. And that was about 50 years earlier. And we find that Mordecai and Esther are therefore from families who decided to remain in Susa. They didn't go home to the promised land. Why didn't they go home? We don't know. But here they are, they're an exiled people living in a strange culture that is anti their God and anti people like them. It's a culture where God is nothing and money and power and sex is everything. A culture where God is invisible, where he's hidden. He seems irrelevant. A culture where he is cancelled out. Ever come across a culture like that? Well, Esther and Mordecai are a bit like people like us. This is the story of people who don't belong to the world. They live in the world, but they don't belong here. They're not of the world. They're exiles. Their home is somewhere else. And as such, they're marginalized. They're powerless. They're invisible under the power of this great empire of Persia, this great world empire. And we're told, aren't we, that Esther and Mordecai keep it quiet that they're Jews. She doesn't tell anyone she's a Jew, verses 10 and 20. She's ashamed? Well, maybe. You tell someone that, you're made fun of. Well, it's an indication, I think, how dangerous it could be as well. Dangerous to be part of the people of God. Don't tell anyone. So in their workplaces, they don't say, I belong to the people of God. Do you know that feeling? You go into the workplace, or you go to the new job, or you start the new course, or you go to the new sports club, and you're thinking, well, I know I should be open about my allegiance to Jesus, but I'd rather not. They're people just like us. And let's be clear on Esther's situation. We might think living in the palace with beauty treatments and great food and all these attendants sounds good. It wasn't good. King is not asking for volunteers. Esther was taken. If you've seen that film, Liam Neeson, Taken. This is what happened to Esther. She's been taken. She's taken from the cousin who cared for her after she was orphaned, taken with the rest of the young virgins of the empire and herded like cattle into the royal harem to be one of the king's playthings, one of his sex slaves. And if the king didn't fancy her, then she's stuck in that harem with no prospects of ever going home. No prospects of future marriage or anything. And even if the king does take a fancy to her, what kind of life is it going to be? Plaything of a pathetic playboy. But we read that Esther prospers in the harem. She wins the favor of Haggai, the eunuch in charge of the harem, and she wins the favor of everyone who saw her. We keep reading that. She wins the favor of. And of all the girls, hundreds of girls in the empire, it's this girl, our girl, Esther, who wins the king's favor and is made queen. And the king throws another feast, and he's all smiles, and he's all charm, and he's all generosity, and he declares a holiday, and it's all just to show what a nice tyrant he is. But just to be clear, this is not a Cinderella story of rags to riches. Sometimes it's presented that way, but it's not, is it? This is the story of gross exploitation. Each night, a carefully prepared young girl brought to the king for him to abuse. Done glamorously, of course, a year's beauty treatment, but it's horrible. It stinks. And if your children's Bible portrays this as a wonderful moment in Esther's life, it wasn't. This is degrading. This is abusive. And today, you know, we hear of this kind of thing happening. It's been on the news recently, hasn't it? And it happens to God's people. We don't hear this on the news, but in places like Pakistan, young Christian girls are taken from their families and they are married off to Muslim men. And we could all probably remember those many girls who were abducted, taken in Nigeria by Boko Haram and married off to jihadists. This is all very real and this is all very relevant. Well, what are we to make of all this? Well, the thing we are to remember when we're reading the Bible, and particularly some of these stories in the Old Testament, that God is the hero. We tend to kind of moralize them and we look for people to follow as examples. You get into a little bit of trouble that way because, you know, what kind of example is Esther here? It's a bit problematic, doesn't it? Where she goes along with the contest. And some people have criticized her, and particularly feminists. She, you know, they say she should have done what Vashti did. But she didn't. We've got to be careful that we don't turn the Bible into moralizing. They're a good person, be like them. They're a bad person, don't be like them. God is the hero of the Bible. Every story is ultimately about him. And that makes the number one question that we ask when we come to Esther is, what is this teaching me about God? About who he is and what he's like and what he's done and why he does it. And that might seem like a strange thing to say about a book where he's not mentioned at all. And we're kind of thinking, well, it doesn't show us anything about God, does it? Well, hopefully over the next few weeks, we'll see that it does. And just for a starter, we do have some clues pointing this way in these first two chapters. There is clues that God is showing that he is in control. So clue one is that reference again to Mordecai's Jewish lineage. Linking it to the big story of the Bible. He's part of the covenant people. He's part of Abraham's family. God chose this people to bless the world. It's just a little clue. But it's a clue, nonetheless, that perhaps there's something bigger going on here than merely Xerxes searching for a wife. Also, if we've read the account of the Bible and God's dealing with his people to this point, we may be thinking, well, this sounds familiar. This has kind of happened before, hasn't it? This kind of thing. Seen it before in Joseph. Remember Joseph? Like Esther, he was taken. Like Esther, he was someone's slave. Like Esther, whenever he went anywhere, he found favor in people's eyes. And he rose to the top. And like Esther, he rose to a very prominent position next to a ruler of a mighty empire. And in Joseph's case, we know that this was God at work to save many lives. And when you see this kind of thing happen again, you think, I wonder if God is at work in Persia. He's doing the same thing with Esther. And then, you know, we read of Esther, this young person of beauty, who through the wisdom of a relative ends up in the royal household, brought up in the king's family. We think, I've heard something similar to that before. Moses. Moses was an adopted child. Moses was a beautiful child. And like Esther, through the wisdom of a relative, he ended up being brought up in the royal household. And we know how that turned out, don't we? This mighty, momentous rescue that God does. Rescuing his people from Egypt. So I wonder. Just a clue. Just a little hint at this stage that God might be at work in Persia after all. And then there's the coincidences starting to mount up. We'll see more of this as we read on. But there's the fact that Vashti just happened to displease the king and refuse him. There's the fact that Esther just happened to be chosen out of the hundreds of virgins who were taken. She just happened to be chosen to replace her, and she just happens to be Jewish. And Mordecai just happens to be employed in the king's civil service, and he just happens to be at the gate that day, just happens to overhear the plot that Bigthana is making to assassinate the king. It just so happened, and it gets us thinking, is this just chance, or could this be God working behind the scenes to put his person in the exact place he wants her to be, to play her part in what happens next, the saving of God's people? Just a tiny clue, but what if, you know, what if through the mess and the brutality and the compromise, because in some ways Mordecai and Esther, they're not perfect, you know, they are compromised. But what if through all that God is working out his purposes? What if there is a God in control who says, you know, whatever is happening in your life right now, I am working my good purposes out? That gives us a glimmer of hope, doesn't it? gets us thinking that if there is a God powerful enough to work out his good plans through the mess of this broken world, then it might just be worth siding with him. It might just be worth entrusting your life into his hands. And then the second clue is there. This is God showing that he's very, very good and loving. So Mordecai and Esther, they're not perfect, and they're part of this special people, God's people, but they're not perfect. And we remember from Deuteronomy 7 that God says, I didn't choose Israel because you were greater and more numerous and so impressive compared to all the other nations. The only reason I chose you, weak, insignificant, flawed, failed Israel, is because I love you. I love you. And as we read this account, we remember that, and we see Mordecai and Esther, they're not perfect, and we might be tempted to write them off, and people have written them off because of their compromise. We might be tempted to do that, but God doesn't write them off. The kingdom of the world says, if you perform well, if you win the beauty contest, you're in, we'll have you. That's our culture. Perform, you're in. And for some strange reason, we think that God says that too, but he doesn't. God takes flawed people, he takes failed people, he takes compromised people like Esther and Mordecai and us, and he doesn't give up on us. He says, I love you. And come and be part of what I'm doing. Come and be part of my people. Come and be part of my kingdom. Just imagine that. Yeah? Just think how good it must be to be part of a kingdom where you don't have to perform well in order to be accepted, welcomed. Just imagine that. Just imagine a kingdom where it's not about how you look. Just imagine it, a kingdom where, you know, whatever you look like and whatever you've done, you are loved and wanted by the king. Imagine that. And it's just a clue here, just a hint. But as we read on in the Bible, we come to the point where the God who is hidden shows himself in Jesus Christ. And we see exactly, so clearly, what kind of king he is. Like Xerxes, he shows us the splendor and the glory of his majesty, but unlike Xerxes, he does it not by flashing his wealth, not by displaying his wealth, but by giving his wealth up. By stepping from the riches of heaven and coming down into our world to serve us. Like Xerxes, he will one day prepare a lavish banquet for his bride. But unlike Xerxes, to be this king's bride, you don't have to enter a competition and perform to win. No, it turns out that he wants you to be his bride, his people, so much that he ends up dying on a cross to win you. And like Xerxes, he makes sure that justice is done for rebellion against him. But unlike Xerxes, he doesn't bring justice by hanging those who rebel him on a pole. Instead, he ensures that justice is done by allowing wicked men to hang him on a pole. He takes the just punishments in place of the rebels so the rebels can live. Imagine being part of a kingdom where you have that kind of king. And Esther is saying to us, yes, the kings and the rulers of this world do seem so impressive, but before you side with them, will you take a closer look? And then will you look again at the King of the universe, the real King of Kings? And will you see his great power and his great goodness and his great love? And side with him. And when you've decided to side with him, stick with him. Will you do that?